It all kind of wove together in this really meaningful way to me, in which I was supported through my personal journey as a patient by the work I was doing as an artist and researcher. And then, on the other direction, the artwork that I produced and the research that I did was also informed by my reflection on what it meant to be a patient and what the role of the patient was. And I'm both object and subject in my work, and I'm negotiating this kind of objectivity and subjectivity within my process, which I think is good for a researcher to do and an artist to do.
Welcome to the latest podcast in our Arts Research Africa dialogue series. These dialogues are intended to stimulate practice, enable research, and inspire collective engagement around the question of artistic research in Africa. I'm Prof. Christo Doherty, Chair of Research in the Wits School of Arts. In this dialogue, I'll be speaking to Dr. Ralph Borland, an independent artist, researcher, and curator based in Cape Town. Ralph has a degree in fine art from the University of Cape Town, a master's in interactive telecommunications from New York University, and a PhD in electrical engineering from Trinity College, Dublin, Ireland. His PhD was a critique of first world design interventions in the developing world. His subsequent postdoctoral work at UCT focused on the African city and North-South knowledge inequalities. He has continued to pursue his interest in democratization and the creative use of emerging technologies with projects such as African Robots, his collaboration with Southern African street artists, where he helped them introduce electronics and mechanics to their practice. His art design piece, Suited for Subversion, Protective and Performance Suit for Street Protest, is in the New York Museum of Modern Art's permanent collection. He co-curated the exhibition Design and Violence at the Science Gallery in Dublin in 2016 and Future Present, Design in a Time of Urgency at the Science Gallery in Detroit in 2020. He has just completed a fellowship in the Institute for Humanities in Africa, HUMA, at UCT, which he concluded with the exhibition Aesthetic Interventions and Artificial Intelligence in Africa, which featured the remarkable collaborative work Bone Flute, which we discuss in some detail in this podcast. Also in this podcast, we discuss how Ralph came to art practice and his first degree, majoring in sculpture and fine art at Michaelis. We examine his lateral move into electrical engineering with his PhD at Trinity and the curatorial work he did at the Dublin Science Gallery. We then unpack in detail his most recent collaborative and ongoing research project, Bone Flute, with the orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rudolf Fenter, the flautist Alessandro Gigli, and the filmmaker Dara Kell. Finally, we consider the relationship between artistic practice, research, and activism in Ralph's work. Useful links to Ralph's project website and other information can be found in the show notes for this podcast. Ralph, hi. Great to have you here as a guest on the Aura podcast. As you know, I've followed your career for a long time now and intersected with you at various points in the career. But what I want to start off with is really, how did you come to art before we get into how you moved into art, science, technology?
Yeah, thanks, Christo. And yeah, thanks for having me on the show. And just to note that I think we first met probably 20 years ago, which is when I came up to WITS and taught an early physical computing class in your program.
Yeah, on digital arts.
And that's just soon after I'd moved back from New York to Cape Town. So that was one of our first encounters back then. And how did I come to art? So it's something that I've been thinking about and writing about even fairly recently in the last few years. And I've been constructing a kind of narrative about myself, which starts with entering a drawing competition when I was 5 years old in Cape Town, when Cavendish Square, the shopping mall here, had a whole lot of baby animals take up residence in the basement and a competition to draw them. So I made a drawing of little goats on grass, and I can actually, in my mind's eye, see this drawing of these little baby goats on a kind of spiky green base. And I won the competition. And the prize was a Playmobil set that was in the window of the toy shop that was sponsoring it. It was a big pirate ship. And I was like really excited to have won this drawing competition. And my mum took me to go get the prize. And then my parents discussed it and they decided that the pirate ship was too violent subject matter. So I got the road construction crew instead, which was extremely disappointing. So I like to frame this as the sort of the beginning of the series of triumphs and disappointments that constitutes the life of an artist, the rewards followed by the defeats. I think actually my journey through art does really start that young. I've always drawn and made things from when I was very small. And even as a teenager, I would be making the platonic solids out of cut up cereal boxes and glue. And I also made lots of things like copper jewelry and wire cars. And I was always taking in things from my environment, growing up in South Africa and Zimbabwe, and trying to emulate them. Even seeing a necklace in a movie, I remember, and then making my own version of it out of cowrie shells when I was 16. So all of that then led me to study fine art at university as an undergraduate, started when I was about 20 in 1994 at Michaelis. That's at UCT. And yeah, obviously a pivotal year, 1994. I feel like maybe I should just say something about that decision to study fine art, because I'd spent a year after high school traveling and I was kind of agonizing the whole time as a 19-year-old about what I should study. And I was entered for social sciences to study psychology, and I had a scholarship from UCT, an entrance merit scholarship to do that. And in my first week of starting at UCT, I changed my course. I spoke to the heads of department and I said, I really would like to change to fine art. And would you let me keep the scholarship if I change to fine art? And they said, yeah, you must do what you want to do. But the whole thing that I was trying to decide in that year between high school and undergrad was, can I justify studying fine art? Because I feel like the world is full of pressing political problems and social problems. Maybe I should study to be a lawyer or a social worker or do something that's activist and directly involved in politics and social change. And even though I like art, is it just self-indulgent and is it going to go anywhere for me? And the reason why I changed right at the last moment is because something in me said, I can use art to do anything. I can use art as a territory in which I can reach into all kinds of other domains, and I can use that as my method for engaging with society. That's why I changed, and I'm very glad that I did believe in that I could use art to do anything I wanted.
And the actual experience of studying art, what happened in the process? Were you confirmed in this conviction that art was a space where one could do just about anything? Did Michaelis allow you to do that?
Yeah, I really liked my experience of being at Michaelis as an undergrad and studying art, but it was also an experience of contesting my environment right from the very start. And that was something I brought in with me from high school, where I had been also a bit of an activist in high school of, you know, refusing to accept corporal punishment and getting suspended and getting involved in public speaking and debating and being a bit of a kind of troublemaker when I was in high school. And when I went to Michaelis, I did well at school. So that I did, you know, I did well in my marks and in my class mainly. I also became a class rep, you know, sort of being representing my class and trying to get us representation on student council. But I also organized letters of complaint about lecturers who didn't spend enough time in the classroom with us. I did that in our first semester at Michaelis. I pushed against a lot of what some lecturers were telling me. And throughout Michaelis, I think there was this process of the art school functioning as something to push against and to define yourself against as well as with. But I say that with a lot of affection. Like, I like Michaelis. I like the experience of it, even though part of it was as students forging our own path and sometimes rejecting what our lecturers told us and even locking our lecturers out of our classrooms, which was something that I did when I was in fourth year. Is me and my studio mate put a big lock on the outside of our door, and then we would come and go through a back door, and sculpture lecturers would come and rattle the door, and we would pretend we weren't there because we just were like, we're sick of you. We don't want to hear what you have to say about our work. But we were so committed to what we did. I think that was the really valuable part, is when you believe in what you're doing so much and you care so much about it. That's really invaluable. I think that's really precious.
What was your specialization?
We start out at Michaelis doing a bit of everything. And the first decisions that we had to make are first to go down to two subjects. And I did photography and sculpture. And then you stay with one for the last 2 years, and that was sculpture. And again, I did a sort of quite a rational decision-making around it, where I thought that sculpture is the medium that can incorporate all other mediums. So rather than having to make a decision which excludes other stuff, I would rather choose a medium that includes everything else. And also, I'm not at all good at painting. I am good at drawing, and I've always liked drawing. That was what I used to do as a teenager, is just draw with a pencil. But painting, no, partly because I'm colorblind. So I just am no good at painting. And I also don't like mess very much. Yeah, I like things that are a bit more ordered. And so I was drawn to sculpture. I really like objects. And I was particularly drawn to industrial processes and the idea of doing things that were more like industrial design. I embraced a language that was less about expressivity and more about fabrication and trying to emulate what I saw with sports shoes or car design or appliances or those kinds of things, working with epoxies and resins and casting and sound and electronics. So that's also part of my journey, is starting to get into technology when I was at art school.
I can hear you were already making a lateral move out of fine art into technology engineering. Can you talk about that lateral move that led you to doing a PhD in engineering at Trinity in Dublin?
Yes. So part of how I described that pathway is that I started getting interested in sound, particularly as an undergraduate art student. And that was partly because I was also a DJ and a club promoter. So myself and my friend started a successful club night when we were in our fourth year. And we did that for a few years afterwards and made a living from doing that. And it was something we really believed in. We really adhered to our type of music, which was the kind of trip hop sound and this kind of crossover sound that was happening in electronic music in the 90s. And I then also wanted to make sound installations. My final year work was a multi-channel sound installation embedded in sculptures. I was doing little things with lights, LEDs and batteries. And then in between leaving undergrad and doing my PhD in engineering was my master's program. So my master's program at New York University, the Interactive Telecommunications program, is where I really learned how to get to grips with digital technologies or emerging technologies, new media as it was called. So I went there in 1999 to ITP at New York University, and I was introduced to not just knowledge itself, but how to acquire knowledge. That's a very important part of the ITP ethos, is work collaboratively, know where to look for knowledge, feel empowered no matter your background, that you can figure things out and you can work in any field that you want to. So that's where I learned how to program microchips, do simple electronics, work with sound and video, graphic design, all of web design, all of that stuff. And I came back to South Africa after my master's and I started teaching that stuff at Michaelis and even at your program. And after being here for a few years, I got a lead to a program at Trinity College Dublin with our mutual friend Nathaniel Stern, had gone over there to see some other ITP graduates, Jonah Brooker Cohen and Catherine Morawaki, who had started working with a engineer at Trinity College, Linda Doyle, who had invited them into her department to work on art and design subjects, though she is a serious telecommunications engineer. But she was becoming increasingly interested in the work of artists. She liked the way we thought. She felt like she could learn from us. And artists like myself and the other people I've mentioned who are interested in technology were also attracted to the idea of actually being in an engineering department. We thought, what would this be like to really be in a technologically focused environment? So that's how I came to do my PhD at Trinity College with Linda Doyle, a supervisor who's now the provost of Trinity College, the top role. And in between being my supervisor and the head of her program, she also had a chair in arts and engineering, which they created for her. So quite a unique intersection. One of the many things you could say about that combination of arts and engineering is that it perhaps talks to high-level work or thinking, as in being an engineer doesn't necessarily mean you know how to fix a car, to put it crudely. It means that you know concepts and ways of thinking and how to approach things. And that could put some engineers in conversation with artists who are also not just about, especially now, being able to make a nice painting. An artist is also someone who looks at society, analyzes it, figures out the things that other people should become aware of and then works out innovative ways of communicating those things to audiences. So artists become these high-level thinkers around investigation and communication, and then can get into conversation with other disciplines like engineering, who are also working on a higher level and not just on the low-level function of their field.
Was there any resistance in Ireland or in the Irish engineering establishment to artists getting PhDs in engineering without the necessary prerequisites or undergraduate degrees?
Yeah. I mean, no, I never did come across that. But Linda Doyle, my supervisor, did say, you've got to promise me not to tell anyone that you can like build a bridge or anything like that, because you can't, you're not qualified to do that. So I said, yeah, fair enough. I understand. You'll know this, Christo, but as far as I understand, PhDs are almost discipline independent. You know, we're all doctors of philosophy. So in some ways, I think a PhD is independent of your field, and it signifies, it should or it could signify your ability to apply yourself to material almost independent of discipline. I mean, I know practically it doesn't often mean that, but I feel like that's maybe how you can get away with it, is that you're there applying higher level thinking to a subject that involves technology. And in fact, my PhD was not very arty. It was quite technical.
As I understand it, you were working on water solutions in the third world.
Yeah. The starting point for me was, you know, when I started my PhD, or when I applied to do my PhD, is I'd gotten really interested in these very attractive design for the developing world projects. You know, so, you know, there's many ways to refer to the South, which is now probably the terminology that I'd use, is the South. Then I was also developing world. You could also say third world. You can talk about first world as being Europe and America, or industrialized, all of that stuff. But anyway, this idea of the formerly colonized, the less developed areas of the world were getting designed for by some people in those areas and some people in Europe and America. And there's a history to this, which is the 60s and 70s, you have the appropriate technology movement, in which people like Schumacher, the economist, are looking at how do you design tools and technologies for use in, say, India or Africa or South America that are easy for people to fix, that are made of available materials, that are a kind of democratic, egalitarian approach to technology, also environmentally friendly, and that help people with basic things. So over decades, you now go into like the 90s and the early 2000s, that approach, the appropriate technology approach, has birthed another approach, which is now talking some of the same language, but is more about talking to funder audiences. And you can take one of the significant examples I use in my PhD is the wind-up radio. So the wind-up radio becomes this icon in the, I think, the late 90s, early 2000s. It's a battery-free radio that you can wind up with your hand, and it gets distributed around the developing world. But it also becomes very popular with, say, people who go camping in America, or it becomes popular with people who see how it's designed for the developing world and want to own one because it's a neat piece of apparatus that doesn't require power and speaks about ingenuity, putting you in touch with communication networks, all of that stuff. So the wind-up radio, designed for developing world use, becomes very popular actually in Europe and America, and then people buy them there. This sets in train a kind of a model or approach. And where I come into it is I noticed a South African invention called the play pump, which is a children's roundabout connected to a water pump that pumps water into a water tank that has billboards on it. And then the billboards are rented out to raise money for the maintenance of the pump. And it's presented as this kind of holistic system that is going to fund its own maintenance, and it's going to provide water to people without having to do the work of pumping or fetching water. So now children's play is going to produce water. So I saw this advertised in South Africa, and I thought, this looks, I don't know how to say this. I mean, I can say it looks amazing, but it looks amazing with a great big pinch of salt. It looks like a story that's being told. It looks like an artwork, but not a really good artwork, more like a kind of a Hollywood movie kind of artwork rather than a complex artwork. It's got a very clear story. It involves children. Children are playing. It obviates work. It's for the developing world. And it's all very neat and happy. And I feel quite skeptical that it actually does what it's supposed to do. But I thought, I'd like to know more about this. I'd like to, on the one hand, appreciate it as a form of storytelling and also something like an artwork. But I'd also like to critique it to go, is it appropriate for what it's meant to do? Maybe people just want to open a tap and get water. Maybe this idea that it's got to have this elaborate setup around it is not what people want. So I entered into my PhD with the intention of studying that piece of apparatus, the play pump, and that became the central study of my PhD. And what it required for me to understand that object was to go into the history of the appropriate technology movement, to go into interventionist art practices that also use the similar approach of creating functional objects that also tell stories to audiences, and critical design, which is this other area of design that's quite art-like, where you design fictional objects and products that tell you something about the social circumstances or the society that uses those objects. That's also called design fiction or discursive design. And I also looked at activist practices around water. So in South Africa, Anti-Privatization Forum, for example, who organized to resist prepaid water meters and prepaid electricity meters, and how they responded to technologies that were placed in their environment. So I sort of brought all of these perspectives to bear on objects like the play pump, with the play pump as the central case study. And it was a very interesting journey to be on, because during the course of my study, the play pump was revealed to be really a failed technology. You know, it was riding high for a while and got tens of millions of dollars of funding from like the US President's Fund, and like all over the world, people were supporting it, but it never really worked. And it ended up being really bad for the people using it, because they were going into remote villages in Mozambique and Malawi, taking out functioning hand pumps and putting in children's roundabouts that worked less well than the hand pump. And children's play was never going to be a reliable source of energy to pump a daily necessity like water. And you ended up with these adult women after a day's work in the field turning these children's roundabouts by hand to pump water. It was harder work than the previous technology that they had. So it really was this actually quite horrible example of the impact of a power imbalance, in which the users were in the developing world, the audiences were in the first world, and it was more important that it told a good story than that it worked well for the person using it. And that was my thesis, and I called it Objects in Development, because I was interested in this idea of objects that communicate and how this is a field that is in development. Like, these objects are becoming more and more prevalent.
And how did you move across into curation? Because then you were involved with curation at the Dublin Science Gallery.
So I curated my first show right after I submitted my PhD, and it was because of two things. One of them was because I'd started working with Science Gallery in Dublin right after they opened in 2008, because I was in the university and I was working in arts and sciences. And I just was immediately drawn to this new institution that, in their title, Science Gallery, they were pitching themselves as different to a science museum, which is one way of communicating science. Science Gallery has a whole different concept, in which they would curate exhibitions that involved artworks, design products, scientific experiments, and events that would explore a theme. Some of the themes might be something like blood. So they take a subject and then how can we explore this through an exhibition that involves all of those different genres or types of objects. So I'd been working with them on and off since 2008, just helping them to run classes, getting involved in some of their projects. And then when I finished my PhD looking at this water pumping technology, they had come up with the idea of doing an exhibition about water called Surface Tension, the Future of Water. So I was invited to be one of the lead curators on that project. And so I spent probably most of a year curating that exhibition along with my colleagues. And yeah, I really enjoyed it, because curating an exhibition involves so many facets. It involves writing texts. It involves selecting objects and communicating with artists and designers and scientists. It involves the visual design of the exhibition, as in the sort of the set design. It involves curating performances and events. So it's this kind of holistic, totalizing kind of art form, which I really like. I like to be involved in the full spectrum of what you can do with a site and a fixed duration of time.
I actually had the privilege with my youngest son, who I think was about 9 years old at that time, of visiting the Science Gallery in Dublin. And I went there with the idea that we were going to a science museum, and it was quite different. And what I really liked was, in conventional galleries and museums, there's usually a path for kids, a little section where they can do crayon coloring in, or, you know, they can do those kind of like childish activities. And then the adults have their path where they engage with the works in a more, you know, mature way. And certainly our experience of the Science Gallery and the exhibits there was that there wasn't that kind of differentiation. You know, both myself and my boy could really involve ourselves in the different exhibits and rooms in the gallery. It was a wonderful experience. I think that was after you'd moved on, but clearly they had that approach.
No, that's great. No, I'm glad you got to experience that firsthand. Yeah, it's a very enthusiastic and dedicated group of people who are involved in doing that. I also appreciate that idea of talking to wide audiences. You're not splitting your audience into different parts, and you are trusting that people can take in complex ideas, and that you can communicate complex ideas to a wide range of people.
Yeah, to my mind, very effectively managed to do that. It's something I've missed here in South Africa. Then what I really want to speak to you about at greater length is your latest project, which you presented as the end of your fellowship at the Institute for Humanities in Africa, that new institute down at UCT. And you had a fellowship there, and you worked on what you called bone flute. And can you talk us through that fellowship and that art come medical science object, which brought together medical science, music, and of course your sculptural, your expanded notion of sculpture and social sculpture, I think as well, was quite an aspect in that project. Can you talk us through that? And it also, quite by chance, ended up being a very powerful personal experience for you because of what transpired during that project.
Yeah, I'll talk you through Bone Flute. It's something that a project that I'm still pursuing and writing about and presenting, and, you know, want to take further. Just to catch up on the time between PhD and that fellowship, just to say briefly that after I did my PhD and after I curated that exhibition, I came back to Cape Town, moved back to Cape Town, and I did two postdocs, one with the African Center for Cities, looking at public art and culture, and then one on a project called Global Arenas of Knowledge that was about Southern theory, and I was interviewing people in climate change, climate research scientists. A few years after that, I've been working as a freelance or self-employed artist doing my projects. And then in March 2021, I went back into the university, taking up a fellowship at HUMA. So HUMA, the Institute for Humanities in Africa, has been around for about 10 years under a range of directorship. It had fallen a bit dormant just in the years before I went there, and it was reinvigorated by an academic, Divine Fur, who relaunched HUMA as a Pan-African research center. So the project that I was brought into is called Future Hospitals, the ethics of care in the 4IR, so the fourth industrial revolution, that rubric around the idea that we are in a fourth industrial revolution. Now the idea is that we're in the fifth industrial revolution, but starting with the fourth, it's looking at things like 3D printing, drones, AI, this whole suite of technologies that are, you know, digital technologies and algorithm and database technologies. The shift from the 4IR to the 5IR, by the way, is about putting the human in the loop. So it's the idea of, can we centralize the human while we are bringing in all of these technologies that also threaten to replace humans? My entry point to this field was, you know, I was given this mandate, look at the role of emerging technologies in healthcare in Africa. And I was part of a team, and each of us were looking at different sites around the continent. I started really close to home at Tygerberg Hospital in Cape Town, you know, a big public hospital. And that was thanks to an introduction from a former arts school colleague who saw me posting on Instagram that I'd joined humor and that this is my field and I was looking for leads. And she sent me a message saying, oh, I know this doctor at Tigerberg Hospital, Rudolf Fenter, who you might find really interesting. He's doing scanning and 3D printing of patients' bones in order to practice surgeries on the 3D prints before they operate on the patient. And he's also really open to art. He takes his students on drawing classes and they learn how to do haptic study of bones. So I think you get on with him. And she gave me his contact details. So that led me to meeting Rudolf Fenter, and Rudolf welcomed me to his laboratory at Tigerberg Hospital and showed me what he does. And he explained his work as he didn't invent this technology, it's in use. This idea of using medical scans to then create digital models that you can then print and then you can do surgical rehearsals. He didn't invent it, but what he was trying to do was to make it low cost for public healthcare environments. And his PhD was looking at low cost modeling. So the idea and what he was doing is you can have better outcomes for patients if they have a complex case that he needs to work on by rehearsing it beforehand. So before you're operating on the live patient, he gets the whole surgical team around the 3D model, and then they use their instruments to rehearse what they're going to do. And they might do that 4 or 5 times before they then do the real operation. And that leads to better outcomes for the patients. It also prepares the surgeon. So the surgeon's work is made better and easier by being able to practice. And what I immediately picked up on, because of some reading that I'd been doing for my research, is that it enhances and enables the skills that the surgeon already has. So surgeons have a very embodied set of skills. Part of what their work involves is these specific environments and experiences of, say, being in an operating theater in the early hours of the morning, having spent several hours on a case, and something goes wrong and you have to deal with it, and they feel their heart rate accelerating and they're perspiring, and they're bringing in these sort of intuitive approaches to how to solve a problem that comes up. And that's based on, you know, hundreds or thousands of hours of experience in this domain. And so when you create a simulation, which is what they're doing by 3D printing these bones and practicing on them, what you want to do is to be able to make it as embodied as possible. So to use, for example, physical models, rather than, say, a simulation which involves looking at a screen, you know, or an approach to rehearsing something that is using a standard set of models that isn't particular to the patient you're about to work on. So both of those aspects, the idea of particularity to a patient, you want to scan a patient, print out their anatomy, and work on something that's very particular to that individual. And also, you want to make it as physical and embodied as possible. And I could recognize that his approach was doing that, and that in doing that, it was running counter to one of the threats that emerging technologies hold for us as humans, is that they have a de-skilling tendency. So airline pilots are the classic example, and I read about this in a book called The Glass Cage, which talks about what automation is doing to work. You know, so in the beginning, airplane pilots were in physical contact with their machines. They actually had, you know, rods and wires that were giving them feedback, and that they were controlling the plane very directly. And the plane became almost an extension of the body of the pilot. Then gradually, sensors and actuators have replaced all those linkages, and now computers are also judging and running things. So now the commercial airline pilot is a kind of custodian of a machine, and they don't really have much embodied experience of what it's like to really fly this airplane. And if something goes wrong, there is a tendency for airline pilots not to be able to respond in a way that will save them from the situation. And also just the sheer quality of their experience, their interaction with their work is diminished. Something that affects all of us is our wayfinding ability with the maps on our phones. So mapping applications on our phones are diminishing our ability to have internal mental maps of spaces that we navigate. And some people theorize that our ability to navigate physical spaces and build these internal mental maps of physical spaces is inextricably connected with our ability to map things like memory or other forms of like navigating inside our minds. So how to be able to access pieces of information and know where they are in a sense. So there's some bodies of thought that say that the diminishment of our spatial navigation abilities through using easy mapping tools on our phones is actually going to diminish a whole lot of other of our capabilities too. So I was reading all this literature around these threats to human experience of work and the retention of our embodied skills. So when I encountered Rudolph and saw his work and heard him talk about it, I thought, oh, well, what's significant about this is that it retains the embodied skills of the surgeon. So it's good material for what I want to look into, this interaction of emerging technologies and healthcare and workers. And I would like to devise a way of working with Rudolph that enables me to find out more about what he does and also enables me to make a creative work, an artwork out of that process.
I find that really interesting. I think this aspect of advanced technologies progressively de-skilling us as workers and that the implication of something like de-skilling in a specific area, like one's navigational sense, one's wayfinding, that by relying on, let's say, GPS, it can have consequences for other aspects of how we engage and comprehend the world. That's a new thought to me that is deeply troubling. But to go back to your engagement with Rudolph Fenter, there was also a musician involved in this project. Was he around at that stage, or was this another chance encounter?
That was another chance encounter, yeah. So here I am introduced to the surgeon. He's using scanning, 3D printing. I'm interested in the implications of what he does. And I'm an artist and a sculptor at the beginning of this research post. And, you know, my general proposal at the start of this research post was I'm going to use creative methods for interacting with health workers. As it happens, I had had an idea about 10 years before, after I'd done my PhD, of extracting a bone from my body through medical scanning and CNC. I have a project called Suited for Subversion, which is a riot suit, a suit for protesters to wear. It's in the Museum of Modern Art in New York. I did it for my master's thesis. And one of its features is a pulse reader that transmits your heartbeat out of your body. So I was reflecting on this work and thinking, I'm really interested in how you can use your body as material for work. And let me do a conscious sort of rational thinking through process of like what other aspects or parts of your body could you use for making art. And I thought, your bones are this real hardy material. Is there a way of using the bones in your body to make work like a sculpture or something like that? So I thought, well, you can CAT scan or use other forms of scanning of your body and you'd make a 3D model and then you could CNC in wood or you could 3D print the bone, and then that would be like extracting the bone from your body. So I'd had that idea, and at first I thought I'd make a club out of it, that it would just be like a knob carry, basically, or a shillelagh. And it's just a basic idea of maybe it says something about innate violence or something like that. And then over the years since, I started refining the idea just in the back of my mind and started doing research. And I came up with the idea of extracting the bone, the femur, as the biggest bone in your body, and making it into a flute. And I was dealing with responding to these images that I had where I'm like, I know I've seen this somewhere, I'm not sure where, but I've seen images of skeletons playing their own bones. And there's something about a hollow bone being made into an instrument. I just know that I've seen it somewhere. And, you know, I started looking around and then you find it in so many places. You know, it's from medieval Europe, this imagery of festive skeletons, you know, skeletons playing instruments at the time of the plague and people really trying to deal with death being ever present. You find it in Tibetan Buddhist practices of making instruments out of human bones. Archaeologically, you find instruments made out of human bone all over the world, and some places they're still made. So I realized that I was tapping into this rich vein of human practice, which is making instruments out of bones. And as an artist, also going, well, this is a really powerful set of symbols, you know, the remains of a dead body made into a musical instrument. And then through medical technology, I could actually take a living body, my own body, and then make an artifact out of it. I had that idea in my back pocket. And so when I met Rudolph and encountered his work, I was like, you know what? Now's a good time to make that work that I wanted to make. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but now I've met someone who actually does that. And the other thing that had happened was that I'd injured my hip while running. I'd really got into jogging and running, trail running on the mountain, and I'd injured my hip and I needed to get a scan in order to find out what was wrong with it. So I asked Rudolf if he could help. I was on the public health system, set me up with a scan. I had my leg scanned in an MRI machine. And then we handed the data over to a medical company called Craniotech that Rudolf works with. And they prepped the 3D model to be able to 3D print it. And when I went to their facility to look at what they were doing with prepping the model, the director, Bernard Swart, said, yeah, you know, I'm also a musician. I play an instrument called the hang drum. And one of my frequent collaborators is this classical flautist, Alessandro Gigli. So if you're looking to make a flute, maybe you should talk to Alessandro. So I said, well, that sounds great. So I met Alessandro, and then he came and worked in my studio, and we prototyped a flute. And we ended up doing a simulated operation using Rudolf's processes. So in his laboratory where he does his simulated operations, Rudolf, Alessandro, and myself worked with surgical drills and instruments to put the holes into the replica of my femur and turn it into a flute. And my partner, Dara Kell, is a filmmaker, filmed it and produced a short film of the performance. So it was this kind of a performance made into a film that then ended up on exhibition. And, you know, one of my mental images from then is looking at Dara, who is about 6 months pregnant at that point with a big video camera. So she's behind the camera, 6 months pregnant with our baby. And I'm also in the middle of chemotherapy. The other thing that happened during the course of this project, I mentioned injuring my hip early on and that enabled the scan. But the other thing that happened is my partner fell pregnant. We're having our first child. And I decide I'm going to go for a colonoscopy because my grandfather died of colon cancer when he was about the same age as I was then. I suddenly got this urge to go, I need to get this checked on. I went for a colonoscopy and immediately the surgeon found the tumor. And next day I was sent for a CAT scan to check the extent of the tumor. Fortunately, it was contained to the site where he'd seen it. And the next week I was having an operation where they were opened me up and cut out 20 centimeters of my colon and sewed the ends back together again. And a few months after that, I started chemotherapy and I did 3 months of chemotherapy for colon cancer. And this was all during the final months of my fellowship. And while I was working on a project about medical technology and about mortality, it was the most extraordinary coincidence and also really, really helpful to me that I was doing that. Because I've had the chance to do quite a bit of writing about this since. The process of writing has kind of made me see things, you know, more about what I experienced. And I think one of the basic facts is that I wasn't brought into the world of surgery and medical technologies and treatment and the hospital cold. You know, I wasn't brought in from the outside, not having had any experience of it. I was actually already immersed in this world as an equal, talking to doctors, collaborating with medical workers. It was just this really interesting sort of sideways step or like little bit of addition to my experience that I was like, oh, well, now I'm a patient, but I'm still a collaborator and a researcher and an artist working with this material. And I'm going to be like really taking in everything that happens to me and seeing if that can also be material for my research and my art. And also, I'm embedded in a story. There's kind of a narrative that's unfolding in which I've been diagnosed with this life-threatening illness, working on a work about mortality. I've been told that I'm going to be okay, so that's good. But I'm going to have to get through the treatment, and I've got a baby coming, so I've got to be ready for that. And that's a reward as well at the end of it, is to have a baby. It all kind of wove together in this really meaningful way to me, in which I was supported through my personal journey as a patient by the work I was doing as an artist and researcher. And then on the other direction, the artwork that I produced and the research that I did was also informed by my reflection on what it meant to be a patient and what the role of the patient was. And I'm both object and subject in my work, and I'm negotiating this kind of objectivity and subjectivity within my process, which I think is good for a researcher to do and an artist to do.
I hear you. And what was Alessandro's opinion of the bone flute. What was it like as an instrument for him as a flautist?
I think surprisingly good, really, because we didn't really know how it was going to work, you know, with a material that he hadn't worked with before. It's resin printing. So look at how it's made. You get filament printing, which is the cheap method, and Rudolf mainly uses filament printing. We ended up using resin printing, which is also used in medical settings, but is a sort of higher resolution print. And we weren't sure, Alessandro wasn't sure how it was going to sound. We first prototyped it on a PVC pipe of the same dimensions, and that sounded good. And we didn't know until the end of that operation, which you can see a video of on our project website. So I've got boneflute.org is a site you can check out the project. You'll see that art video there. And you can see Alessandro playing the bone flute, which is the very first sounds that are made on it are him doing it after we've been drilling the holes in it. And it sounds great. It sounds haunting. It sounds how you would expect a bone flute to sound. And that was great. That's good. You couldn't ask for more. That's a good reward. I mean, it would have been a bit flat if it hadn't sounded good or hadn't made a sound. In fact, it sounded kind of breathy and bony, and how you might think something would sound played in a cave tens of thousands of years ago is how that flute sounds.
I'm reminded of the Tarkovsky film where the young boy has to lead the fabrication of a bell. Alexander Nevsky, I think it's called. It's set in like early Russia at the time of the Mughal invasions. And this boy is the only one left of a religious community whose building, the church, has been destroyed. And through the memory of what the bell looked like, he has to lead a team of craftsmen who recreate the bell.
Yes, yeah, no, I think I have seen it. I know what you mean.
Yeah, at the end of the film, they pull off the molding and it's lifted up and it's struck. There's the sense that if the bell actually rings true with a clear note, then he's been successful and the community and Russian Christianity, I imagine, will survive.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't, if the bell rings flat or shatters, you know, it'll be a disaster. And the bell rings true. So after all of this struggle and process, and there seems something with that bone flute of yours.
Yeah.
And then I'm interested, you presented this in an exhibition as the culmination of your fellowship at HUMA, and you called the exhibition Aesthetic Interventions in Artificial Intelligence in Africa. I'm intrigued by that. Where was the artificial intelligence in this project?
So in some sense, that was the artificial intelligence focus was a carryover from the starting point of the research fellowship, which is let's pay a special attention to AI. So I did do some work in my fellowship that looked directly at AI. I was particularly interested in cultural attitudes towards AI. So I looked at AI as a form of divinity. I read this very interesting book called God, Human, Animal, Machine that looks at this idea of religious feeling transferred to AI as a kind of godlike power. And I looked at things like the I Ching and the Ife divination system from Nigeria and tried to explore this idea of how we think and feel about AI. And also AI appeared in some just odd ways in the process of the project, such as in order to create a usable printable model from the scan of my leg, they ended up having to use a process called statistical shape modeling that took an imperfect scan of my femur, combined it with data from hundreds of other femur scans and produced a sort of averaged out model that was my femur, but also had the features of hundreds of other femurs. And that was just an incidental way that AI entered the project. But yeah, that title was more to do with the overall scope of my fellowship, of which bone flute was the major piece, but wasn't looking directly at AI, was looking more at another technology of the fourth industrial revolution.
And how did you curate that exhibition with just a single flute? How do you make an exhibition out of that?
Yeah, so for one thing, the site was important. So I had a studio space in Cape Town and Woodstock for the past 10 years or so. And they have a little artist-run space that's at street level. It's got a window onto the street. It's painted black and there's this, you know, room with windows and an attractive little space. So I chose to use that as my exhibition space that was on the threshold of my personal and public life and, you know, my work as an artist and my work as a researcher. And I had showed the object bone flute, and then I created these rearrangeable panels on the walls. So I made rails, like channels, that had image cards in them. The image cards showed material related to the bone flute project and to my wider work on AI and divinity and access to healthcare and so on. And I also used my medical scans both as video on screens and as transparencies stuck onto glass, the windows of the space. And I showed the video that we'd made of the performance to make the flute. I made a poster, which you've seen, which highlights the kind of sensational aspect of my project. It says, "Man makes flute from own bone." And I produced a kind of tabloid poster that was one of the works in the exhibition as a way of saying one of the jobs that my work is doing is to draw attention to an area that I want people to find out more about. And here's a kind of clickbaity, sensational way of drawing people in. So I created a space, had a work table in the middle that had some of Rudolph's 3D models and papers about his work. We actually brought a 3D printer into the space and we printed out little miniature copies of my femur that you could use as a key ring or put around your neck. And so gallery visitors could take away a little tiny copy of my femur with them. And it's like a playful way of drawing people into the material. It's almost a form of science communication where we direct people's attention to an area that as non-technical people can get some insight into and see demonstrated. So I communicated through image, text, and video. And most importantly, I was there in the space for much of the exhibition run, treating it as a kind of working, living laboratory in which I would show people around the exhibition and tell them the story, tell them the whole story of Rudolph's work, my artwork, and my personal experience, and how all of those things combined and what that says about the uses of medical technology in healthcare.
And what was the kind of response that, let's say, people off the street attracted in by your tabloid poster? How did they react to this show?
Well, they were intrigued by it. The gallery space that's called Brutal has little cards that they put out that people can write notes on and then submit. So I've got a little collection of people's responses to the exhibition, and from children and adults and, you know, a whole range of people. And I think people were moved and intrigued, and that the video shows people the flute getting played. The object itself is intriguing. It's a recognizable bone with, you know, made into an instrument. And there's a range of brief texts and images that help to sort of ground them in it. So I think that people were entertained and moved and intrigued. And it also, in conversation with people, even gives them some practical advice around, say, their options as patients. Like, I spoke to people who said, "Oh, I had a knee op a year ago. I wonder if the outcomes would have been better if the surgeon had practiced on a print beforehand," you know, or someone might go, "Well, when I need a hip op or a knee op, I should see if the surgeon is going to use that method." So it gave people insight into the possibilities, the options that were available to them.
Ralph, just to conclude, I notice you call yourself an artist-researcher. Do you think it's necessary to differentiate the researcher function from the artist? Many would argue that art necessarily requires some kind of research. Even the most traditional oil painter is needing to do some research. But is an artist-researcher a different kind of an artist?
Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, you know, you're also into music, and it's like these debates around whether these micro-differentiations of musical genres are like necessary or what they refer to. And so probably my response would be that it's about a hierarchy or a non-hierarchy of those roles of the artist and the researcher. So when you mention the example of an oil painter needs to do research in order to make the painting, that sounds like almost the research is a means to get to the art. Whereas when I use the term artist researcher, they're sitting next to each other, where the artwork and the research are intertwined, but they're not the same thing. I didn't do the research in order to make the artwork. I made the artwork as a means of interacting with a collaborator to research their field. So it's like the art and the research are separable and they support each other, and one is not in the service of the other. They're both side by side. Though in another way of relating to your question, why wouldn't I just call myself an artist? because artists can do anything, as I said at the beginning. So an artist can be a researcher, they can be an activist. The word artist can sum all of those things up. Perhaps I'm proselytizing a bit with the word artist researcher. I'm saying artists are legitimate researchers and can apply art as a way of accomplishing a whole variety of ends.
Great. I think you put it very eloquently. Ralph, thank you very much. And I will provide in the show notes links, obviously, to the project site, the Bone Flute site, and hopefully any other links that would be useful for listeners wanting to follow up on your, right back to your MA days, your challenging work on the boundaries of art, science, technology, and activism. Let's not forget that. There's always a very strongly activist strain in whatever you do, and I respect that greatly. So, Ralph, thank you very much.
Sure. My pleasure, Krista. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
You've been listening to a dialogue between myself, Krista Doherty, the Chair of Research in the Wit School of Arts, and my guest, the South African independent artist, researcher, and curator, Ralph Borland. This podcast was hosted and produced by myself, with technical production by Elner Schutz. The music for this podcast was composed and performed by Leroy Zvier and is used under a Creative Commons license.